Hi, I'm Michael, and welcome to Beyond the Screenplay, the podcast where each week we do a conversational deep dive analysis into a film. Today, we're talking about Bruno, one of the main characters in Encanto, the 2021 film directed by Jared Bush and Byron Howard, co-directed by Charisse Castro-Smith, screenplay by Charisse Castro-Smith and Jared Bush. I'm joined by the Beyond the Screenplay team, Trisha Arand.
Hello, everyone.
Brian Bittner.
Hello, hello.
And Alex Cayetas.
Hi.
Okay, so Encanto. We haven't talked about an animated movie for a little bit, and there's been quite a lot of hype and buzz around this. As I mentioned in our previous episode, some close friends have been yelling at me for a long time to watch this movie, and people keep saying, we don't talk about Bruno, and I don't know why. And so I was like, okay, I'm excited to finally watch this and understand what is going on with this movie. And it is lovely and great and very well done. Has a really solid screenplay, and the morals and themes feel just very like modern and good. And yes, like I'm so happy this kind of movie exists. I think there was a little bit of that, like a minor bit of resistance because of all the hype and because of the like, it's the best thing ever. And like, you're going to love the music and everything's going to be great. And I was like, okay, but like, is this the best thing ever yet? I'm waiting. But pretty immediately I was swept up in it, and the characters and the arc and the animation is just gorgeous. Like,
it's gotten so good.
Like,
my God.
Like, there's been great animation for forever, but for some reason, like, this movie, I was like, it elevated what was already great to an insane level. And the hair texture was so good. It was like the best hair I've ever seen. Yeah, sand in the hair.
If Michael likes sand, time, you know, something's going on.
Exactly, exactly. I really enjoyed myself, and it was fun. Yeah, rewatching parts and going and watching some of the kind of like behind the scenes making of stuff that they have on Disney Plus and learning more about it. Just such a wonderful film that I'm glad exists. Yeah, thumbs up from Michael. I'm curious to hear your guys. Brian, why don't we start with you? What was your take on Encanto?
Yeah, I was also a little resistant, and actually for a different reason, which was just the few people that I know who saw it were like, yeah, it was fine. Like, just like it was another one of these, you know, and I'm fine with these. By these, I mean the sort of, you know, the yearly Pixar or Disney animated movies that we, you know, that we're getting right now, all of which are, you know, tend to look gorgeous. I just watched Coco for the first time recently on, you know, that and this on just like 4K TV, just all the color, you know, outstanding. When I watched this, it had that sort of that thing that you want as an adult watching this kind of movie, especially when you don't have kids, right? You're just watching it with your adult partner and being like, well, we're watching this movie. And then you're like, oh no, I don't feel alienated, right? Like, I don't feel like this movie is for a different audience than me. And I'll get into some of that later, but it's that sort of thing of one, just feeling like the animation is going the extra mile and the songs are really good, but also feeling like the writing is really smart and it's not talking down to you. And like really feeling like, oh no, I'm genuinely laughing at this. I'm not laughing because it's like a funny joke for kids. Just had a really lovely time with it. It was also, I was surprised how quick it was over. I think there was this like, again, this like Disney brain was going, well, now they have like, there's the evil wolf spirit that was in the house that they have to battle for 25 minutes, you know? And it was just like, no, like they've healed their issues and the house is back and that's it. The movie's over. And I thought, I mean, it took me by surprise, but not in a bad way. Just it felt like such an abrupt ending, but also what a great thing to be able to provide to younger audiences right now is a movie where this feels like the arc of just a family drama that made for adults, basically, you know, like a sort of, we, you know, we lost our child and we have to, you know, repair finally at the end where we feel okay now, like that kind of very Oscar-y movie or something. Those are the kind of movies that have that arc where it's just like a, like the big finale is just things are okay now. And it was just lovely to see a movie like this where the big finale was just a family repaired and a house repaired, literally. And for that to just be enough to give you and hopefully kids the emotional payoff that a movie should be able to have without having to be have some big giant set piece at the end.
Yeah, there's no like, and now we need to go stab the bad guy so that we win.
Right,
like,
exactly.
There's none of that.
Heal the family through violence.
Yeah,
and, right. And murder.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to talk about other movies right now, but it'll be spoilers, so I won't. Alex,
what,
there you go. Yeah, Alex, what was your take?
Yeah, a similar theme here where it wasn't so much I was skeptical because it was an animated movie or a Disney movie. It was because it wasn't a Pixar movie. And I have like a Pixar bias where, you know, last year Soul was just like my movie. And it was Pete Docter was just speaking to me and it's about jazz, like adult things. You know, it wasn't even for kids almost. The cat was for kids, but everything else was for me as an adult. And so when this movie began and it presents itself as more of a traditional like Disney kids movie where people do break out into a musical number, kind of like the old days. Like it felt like I haven't been keeping up with these non-Pixar Disney movies, like the Frozen movies that I know are, you know, have these hit singles that people are obsessed with. I've been out of that scene, so I don't know what's going on over there. And so I haven't been seeing animated movies that have just, we're going to sing for a while now. And it's going to be about my inner feelings and about my character, and we're just going to do that. And so when this movie was presenting itself as that, which is something that I grew up with, you know, in the kind of golden era of Disney, it was feeling like, okay, yeah. So I'm like, this looks like a gorgeous state-of-the-art Pixar movie. And yet the form is hearkening back to kind of like my 90s childhood days of this really just earnest classical musical format. And so at first I was a little bit like, is this just for kids then? Like, it's not really for me. It's going to be just a bunch of people singing about their feelings. But as the movie went on, I was saying before we got on the podcast, it was like, I started off in this kind of resistant, you're not Pixar mode, all the way to like, I was definitely choking back tears, like throughout like the last like third of the movie. And I was like, why am I feeling so emotional? This is like a kid's movie. This has like been classified in my mind as like a lesser Disney type of movie. But no, it was getting me as misty eyed as the best Pixar movies. So it was good for me to kind of like wash away my bias and realize, oh no, like there's just as much depth and emotion and richness here in this kind of more classical Disney form, and just as much cleverness and really great character design and really great, you know, story design. So yeah, this movie won me over, and I was skeptical that Disney without Pixar couldn't do it for me, and they did it for me. So yeah, I am also a fan.
Nice.
Yeah, no, there's definitely like this weird blend of like classic and also hyper modern that's just like super right. working for me this whole time. I want to talk about more. But yeah, Trisha.
Yeah. So I mentioned this on the podcast as a what am I watching? And I also mentioned it in the same breath with as Mitchell's versus Machines, which is also about, you know, a teenage girl who like is trying to, you know, connect with her family kind of thing. And actually, I recently also watched Disney's Turning Red, which is also on your Disney Plus and is also kind of about this exact same thing, which is about, you know, she's a girl going into adolescence in that movie. But she's got like family, like generational sort of issues and like expectations about her life. And, you know, it's about this, you know, young woman who lives in Toronto and like, anyway, she's, it's a long story, but she turns into a red panda and then like her mother like reveals that all the women in their family turn into red pandas when they like, you know, become adolescents. And
it's Teen Wolf
a bit.
Okay. I'm in.
But anyway, but it's that is also sort of about like, how do you confront you know, trauma that you've inherited sometimes, or just the weight of your family's legacy on your shoulders. And it's interesting that a lot of these films, all three of the ones that I just mentioned, kind of have, you know, arcs for the central relationship is like a daughter and a parent or a grandparent, or sometimes both in the case of Turning Red. She has to reconnect with her mother and her grandmother in that movie. And, you know, this is not new material necessarily. Like, you know, I think Mulan, which was sort of the one of the last of the Disney Renaissance movies, is trading in this sort of thematically. But I think that where this movie succeeds is that it has this incredible scope to it, where it's really hyper focused on the family. As you guys are pointing out, there's not a villain, right? And the stakes never get bigger than like our house is breaking. Like right. And like the magical gifts that we have are potentially fading, but the movie never cares to, you know, like if Louisa can't lift things anymore, then the world will end, right? Like right. The movie never, you know, bumps out the stakes and out and out and out, because it isn't about that. And also, this is a period movie. Like, it's set in 1912, I think they said, ish, or like right around the turn of the century almost. But you'd never know that. Like, it's just kind of in this time out of place, right? Like, it's in a village and people aren't speaking in any particular sort of, you know, English of a time. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Right. And so I think that there's just a really fascinating thing happening with this movie. Whereas the other ones that I mentioned, all of them are very much also like about the time, about the place. They're about some kind of apocalypse. They're about some kind of like the city's under attack, or like, yeah, there's a robot apocalypse, or like there's, you know, China's being invaded by the Huns. Like, and this is just like the candle might go out. And right. I feel disconnected from my family, and I feel like I've disappointed them. And those are literally the entire stakes. For some reason, I find this so much more accessible than I don't want to say more accessible necessarily, but I do think it hits in a certain place a little bit differently, where it's so easy to imagine yourself in this situation. Magical powers aside. Right, where we all know what it's like to have a parent or a grandparent or whoever that has, we feel is disappointed in us and who we are. And so I just think that that's so beautiful thematically. And we can get into all of that more. And the animation and the songs, I think the songs are a huge part of the reason why this movie stands out from the pack. They are so catchy, like... I wish I could describe to you the number of days between when I first saw this movie and now that I've had nothing but these songs rattling around in my brain. It is so exhausting, like, but in a way that you just have to respect and admire. Like, the Family Madrigal is like, whew, that one in particular just worms its way into your brain. And it's something about Lin-Manuel Miranda's lyrics, too. He's a lyricist. That it's the lyrics that are just like, it's time for a grandkid roundup, and like all of those like things, they just get into your brain. Even the title, We Don't Talk About Bruno, as a phrase, is like catchy and fascinating, right? And piques your interest and things like that. So anyway, this movie works and like wins on so many levels, and I hope we get more that are like this from Disney, you know, Disney Animation. So
yeah, I agree, but I also think Lin-Manuel has to be stopped. Tick, Tick, Boom, In the Heights, Encanto, Vivo, and one am I missing?
Hamilton?
I mean,
this year.
Oh, okay.
This year.
Oh, wow. He did like take a nap. Five movies or something, or yeah. Like was somehow responsible.
Involved.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's very impressive. Yeah, well, and so it was interesting. So as the movie started off, I was thinking about the kind of the opening, you know, prologue explanation of like what happened is like a little dark, like, you know, being chased down by men on horses, like that's all, it's very scary. But then it goes hard into like, and then magic, like just what if like, no, literally this is magic. This isn't like, you know, a symbolic representation of what was actually physically happening. Like this is a magical place. That was an interesting choice for me, but it came early enough that it didn't like throw me off. And then the way that they used all these magic abilities to characterize all the characters and their internal struggles, mm-hmm. it was just like so clever the way it was done to make everything emotional, but also make it very clear the things that each character, you know, I have to be this way or that way to impress somebody. But also you can clearly see how too much of this would, you know, causes a problem. And I think that is another, you know, the three dimensionality of every character was done very efficiently, where you understand this is their superpower, but like, this is also the too much of a good thing that's causing the problem and keeping them, like, it's almost, you know, the thing that's trapping them and preventing them from being their true self. And so I think all of that ended up being just rendered literally in a very beautiful way. So it was another one of the arcs that I went on of like, wait, we're doing literal magic here? I don't know, to like, this is wonderful. I want to stay in this world for forever.
Well, it's interesting because I was thinking as this movie began, you know, that opening sequence, it reminded me of other Disney movies or Pixar movies where the what if is like kind of a stretch, and it's also specific and complicated in a way that it was like a balancing act to like explain quickly and get you on board with. It's like, don't question it. Like, this candle turned magic, and this candle made a house, and the house is like a Beauty and the Beast house, and it like has a personality and can move around. Also, the house has doors, and the doors present themselves to the children when they turn a certain age, and they touch the door and they get a special superpower of some kind. And that is like that's what the world is of this movie. And it's such a specific what if that then it reveals itself to be all for a reason, all for good story and character reasons. But it is like, it was like a bumpy ride going in, because I'm like, does this what if have to be this complicated? Like, mm-hmm. do all these rules come out of the same like kernel, or are they just like random things that they're just throwing against the wall? Like, yeah, a candle and a house and the doors and the powers. But by the end of the movie, it was like you're saying, Michael, it feels like it is all there to be this magical realism representation of solid family dynamics and solid thematic and character things. You know, even like the home cracking and breaking, it's like a literal broken home. Yeah, so all of the magic is representational, even though in the world of the movie it is literal. And that's when I appreciated that it was just like, okay, this is weirdly specific and complex magical setup, but all of it is for a reason. It's not just random rules for rules' sake. It's thematic and symbolic. But it's impressive and difficult to set up these kinds of worlds in a movie because they are so kind of strangely specific and have rules that could just fly off the handle if you don't handle them well.
Yeah, I think one thing that helps, I mean, we actually talked about this a little in Scott Pilgrim, which is you can kind of have a nonsense world with nonsense rules when it doesn't actually interact with what we would consider the real world, you know, like, so in Toy Story, there are humans. So you do have to kind of do a balancing act where you're like, here are the toys, here's what they can do. But also a human is going to walk into the room and the toys have to be still and, you know, they might get thrown out and whatever. And like if a toy is on a truck, that truck is going, they can't just teleport home, you know, we have to go get them. But in a movie like this, there is the village, you know, that they live in. But for the most part, it's not, oh, here's a magical family running around New York, right? And like, what right. what does that mean? Yeah. And like, this power. It's no, this entire world, this entire story world is just magical family. So you can get away with saying there's this power and this power, because you don't have to then follow through with what those rules mean in the bigger picture, right?
Right.
And I love the way that it is revealed, which is, you know, her, Mirabelle singing to the kids and saying like, oh, this, because you, especially if you don't know anything about this movie, you are kind of going like, oh, is this, does she mean literal magic? Like you were saying, Michael. And then it's like, oh, these like funny kind of cartoony powers they have. So it's like, oh, we're having a good time here. And then we build up to, you know, what's your power? What's your power? What's your power? Oh, she didn't get one. la la. And then, but the cool thing is we open with her as a child, but we don't actually see her ceremony until it is, you know, placed up against her cousins. And then we're seeing him get his like wonderful animal, you know, Ace Ventura power.
Playground.
Right. And then we're seeing that cross cut with her, you know, her not getting hers and then her, you know, waiting on a miracle song and everything. So it's like it helps kind of keep that all grounded because we build into it. And then when we do get the most magical in the first act, we then are cutting to Mirabelle being like, but not me. And then her just kind of like singing her song to herself while everyone else is in slow motion, that beautiful sequence. So I think it does a lot of work to make it not feel like you're just seeing 12 different rules just in a mishmash for no reason.
This episode of Beyond the Screenplay is sponsored by Curiosity Stream and Nebula. Curiosity Stream is the best place to find thousands of great documentaries on all kinds of subjects. For example, right now they're doing an 8-week special event called Secrets of the Universe. A recent episode is on Skylab, NASA's first space station. Before the International Space Station, Skylab was humanity's first home beyond our planet. This episode is all about the first astronauts to live on a space station and what their work taught us about what it takes for human beings to live, work, and play in outer space. An annual plan for CuriosityStream is less than $15 a year when you sign up at our link, curiositystream.com/screenplay. But it gets even better. When you sign up at that link, you also get complimentary access to Nebula. Nebula is a subscription streaming service where you can support your favorite creators while getting access to a bunch of exclusive content. It was created by and features a bunch of educational-ish YouTubers, many of whom you probably know. Maggie Mae Fish, Just Right, Like Stories of Old, Game Maker's Toolkit, Nando V Movies, and many more. It's a place where we can create experimental content without having to please the YouTube algorithm gods. There are no sponsor spots, and you can get extended cuts of public videos as well as original companion videos and series. It's a great way to support your favorite creators, and, as I mentioned, when you sign up for Curiosity Stream, you get access to Nebula as well. So head to curiositystream.com/screenplay to get access to Nebula and Curiosity Stream for less than $15 a year. The link is in the show notes or on screen right now if you're watching on YouTube. Thanks to Curiosity Stream for sponsoring Beyond the Screenplay.
Yeah, I was thinking a lot about The Incredibles as I was watching this because that's also about a family who all have different powers, right? And the thing about magical powers when you're kind of picking them, right? And I feel like this is one of these questions you get asked in like middle school, right? Like, if you could have any superpower, what would you pick? And everyone's like, I would fly, obviously. But like when you're picking, oh, Michael's face says no, he would not fly.
That's obvious to me.
I mean, it's a little conspicuous. I think it makes you a target.
But go ahead. It's a good point.
We're not being strategic, Trisha.
Yeah. All right. Well, circle back. Well, you guys think about this question. We'll come back to it. But but it's kind of one of those questions. And when you're picking superpowers for characters in this kind of like magical world, they need to be like specific and like bounded enough, right? And so like you have Dolores, for example, who can hear anything that's happening in the village, but it's not like she can hear military secrets being shared in Washington, D.C. You know right. what I'm saying? And you have Louisa, who can move a church and maybe reroute a river, but she's not Superman, right? She probably can't like turn the earth the other direction kind of thing. So they have to be like grounded in terms of like scale. And that also keeps us from wondering too much about what this family does with their powers, because we can't really tell and it doesn't seem to be much. Like, you know, you have Mirabelle's mother who is like healing people in the village, presumably with her cooking from like minor ailments. Can she bring someone back from the dead? I doubt it. Like how wounded can they be? And like her cooking would fix them again. The movie doesn't want us to wonder about that stuff. And so what they show us has to be narrow. It has to be like, my dad gets bee stings, my mom gives him an arepa, and then he's fine. You know, and like, it has to just be very kind of narrow in that way. Same thing with like Dolores's powers. Like, what's his name that shapeshifts? He literally seems to do nothing whatsoever with his power.
Helps the guy hang up a banner one time.
Okay,
matching his height. That's like the one helpful thing I noticed.
Yeah, well, actually, that's a great call, Alex, because again, the powers are being played for character reasons. And, you know, as the characters for like bigger characters like Luisa and Isabella, but then as the characters are like sort of more and more tertiary, like her aunt, right, who controls the weather, mm-hmm. like that's more of just like a comedic power over there. Right. So like, does she actually cause storms or seasons? Like, can she help the crops grow in the village? The movie doesn't want us to wonder about that. So it doesn't show us anything about that. And I think that that's super smart because it just kind of focuses on, this is not a family that's here to fight crime. This is not a family that's here to do anything other than like kind of help out their neighbors. It's kind of all they're here to do. But that's not what the conflict of the movie is, right? The Incredibles are here to fight actual supervillains. And the central conflict is that the world doesn't want superheroes and yet they are superheroes. And then there's also internal conflict, but not caused by their powers in those films about the Incredibles. In this movie, all the conflict is internal. All of it is not about what your powers are necessarily. It's about, are you, you know, measuring up to some arbitrary standard that the abuela has for you? And so I think that that's just, I just think it's a, I don't know how they pulled it off, to be honest. Like, I don't know how nobody spends the first half of this movie wondering about, like, well, what are they going to do now with all these powers? They're not going to do anything. They're not going to do anything.
Right.
They're going to sing some songs, and that's it. That's not what the movie's about. And how did you get this? The audience isn't wondering, how did you get it by Disney execs? You have 12 magical characters with 12 different magical powers, and they're not doing anything with them. They're and somehow that's your movie. It's brilliant, but it is a bold choice.
They're saving it all for Encanto. Wow.
No. Oh, they are making a show, though, by the way. Or it hasn't been officially announced, but they're definitely.
Oh, like the Family Magical.
Disney Plus.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
About one of the other siblings, I think, or something.
Because you have to.
I guess so.
Well, yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there where, like, the conflict is not about any of that. Like, at no point in this movie is there ever an instance where it's like, oh, there's going to be a time where you're really going to need to punch someone hard, so you better make sure that, you know, Luisa's around to, like, hit someone. Like, all of the obstacles, all of the conflict, everything in Mirabelle's, journey is all... has nothing to do with like external like power. And so, it's just the movie is not concerned with that. And instead we get to see all those powers and like delightful character defining ways or things that sort of show, you know, here's how the family like gets along and here's how these powers can come together. So we get to see like what the family is like at its best and when everybody is like, you know, happy and together. But we also see the downside of both of those. And I think that's, again, I kind of keep coming back to that, but that each character has this, like, the positive side and the negative side of the gift that they've been given all the way up to the abuela, who's like, who is the antagonist, but also is someone that you completely empathize with and understand. And you understand the desire she has of, like, I want to protect this thing. I want to protect it so much that I'm, you know, potentially like killing it in a way. And so that the powers can exist while also doing all of that is also impressive.
Well, because the powers aren't there for a final battle where you need each one of the powers, like an Avengers style, you know, this perfect combination of superpowers can defeat the enemy. They really are there as just fun, magical expressions of who these people are in this family, like the roles they're expected to play, you know. So you've got, you know, the strong one who's just supposed to be there to kind of like be there for everybody, help everybody out, be the solid rock for the family, Luisa. You've got Isabella, who is the golden child, who's just, you know, who's going to be the one, obviously, who's going to marry the hunk from town. Obviously, like, she will be the perfect person. And so all of the powers are really just kind of a fun expressions of like roles that people fall into in families, and they're not there for fighting a bad guy, or for even, yeah, like you're saying, Trisha, not even really doing that much for the town besides moving some donkeys maybe and putting some flowers around.
Yeah, they
but yeah, they're definitely seem to be like needed and loved by the community, but yeah, they're not like saving the world with these powers. And I think it's cool, and that's why the movie, as it went on, it became more and more clear to me that it wasn't a bunch of randomness. It was using this conceit of magic as a way to express and externalize family roles. And that's really interesting. When you have a movie with 12 people in it, 12 family members in it, that's a really neat device to very quickly like make an archetype out of each of these characters and identifiable archetypes. You got Bruno, who's kind of the maybe like neurodivergent or like weird uncle who kind of is, you know, ostracized from the family. Like we all like understand that, like that is a thing. And I, as the movie kind of wraps up, it really all comes together for me. And I'm like, man, like this did the family thing like more clearly and better than I think most other like kind of family Disney movies have done, where it's not just kind of like a singular like mother child father child relationship being repaired. It's like an entire family network of family archetypes all having to kind of like deal with like, yeah, this is the role that I've been kind of put in by this family community, and you know, can I be more than that and be my full self and still be in this family and still all stay together? And so it's a really complex family web that I just haven't seen done before in this kind of a movie.
Well, and just returning to that opening song, which is the Family Madrigal, like mm-hmm. it is an incredible feat that movie does such a good job of introducing every single one of those characters in a way that is clear and followable. Even if it kind of blows by you the first time you watch it, watching it again and listening to the music again, the structure of that song is perfect, right? It starts with Abuela, it goes with the three triplets, right? And it's like, here's my aunt, here's my mother, here's Bruno. We don't talk about Bruno. And then it goes down into the next generation where they go into the grandkid roundup. Here are my two cousins, and then Antonio, who gets his gift today. And then here are my two sisters. And then that's all of us, basically. By the way, these guys married in. Don't worry about them. They don't have magical powers. And then it goes back through them all in the end. There's like
it has like a reprise in the song.
to reinforce, like, again, once again, I will tell you all about them again. Here's Abuela again. Mm-hmm. Here's my aunt. Here's my mother. And then here's all the cousins. Here's my siblings. And it does a really good job of being like, I'm going to get them quickly, like go through them quickly, but we're going to visually show you because this is animated and what, you know, the characters also have really distinctive looks. And we've talked about that, but like, they have distinctive powers. They have distinctive looks. The song is structured to like take your hand and guide you through the family tree. And like, it funnels you from Abuela out to down through the generations. And then it funnels you back to Mirabelle. And like, as you're pointing out, Brian, earlier, it just hammers home, like, and then you Mirabelle, and then you Mirabelle, and then you Mirabelle. What about you?
Right.
And that's what a great, you know, I do want to talk about like the songs that animated movies have and a lot of musicals, but especially like in the style of a Disney, like, especially like a Disney Renaissance musical. There are very, very specific musical numbers, and you basically have to have one of these songs to put in each one of those boxes. And, you know, so this is like the opening, here's the world song. And if you want to think about Beauty and the Beast, which is a perfect example, yeah. Right? It's like, here's a town, bonjour, bonjour, and here's Belle, she's so unusual. And it gives you the world, it gives you the main character, and then, you know, Belle has that wonderful reprise that's her This Is What I Want song, which is the one that's always come second. And this is a great example. Family Madrigal is a great example because it does give us the whole world. The whole world is this family, and this family is these 12 people, and it's a lot of people to keep straight, but it works.
Yeah, and I did find myself, as you were saying, the first time through going, okay, there's a ton of characters. Of course, I'm not going to remember any of them. That's fine. This song is clearly not expecting me to. But then when it did the you know, one more time at the end of the song, I was like, oh, okay. Don't ask me to, like, name all of them or anything like that, but now I feel a slightly, you know, a bit more grounded and in place. I'm like, right, there's a weather person. Okay, there's a strong person. Like, it just did that little extra bit for me then when 5 minutes later in the movie they reference one of them. I'm like, oh yeah, I remember you from the song because you told me twice that this person exists.
Yeah.
And throughout the movie, the powers are always with them. Play. So yes. Like you don't have long stretches where the characters are just walking around like normal people and we forget who's who. It's like Ant, who creates the weather, is always creating weather. And, you know, Kid, who can shapeshift, is always shapeshifting. There's not ever long stretches of time where we have to like remember them for their like names or even their faces. It's like, I know you because you're like floating down here on flowers. Like you are the flower girl.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and even in that opening song before the reprise, I think they say textually in it, like, I know this is a lot of people to like keep track of here. Yeah, right. Like we'll talk, but like signaling to the audience that it's like, it's okay. And that was actually an important moment for me because I was definitely lost at that point. So that the movie was saying, it's okay to be a little confused. Like, don't worry. You haven't been thrown off. You're still on the ride. We got you. Is nice. And then, yeah. So like Bruno is also just a really interesting character. I'm trying so hard to say, not say like, I want to talk about Bruno, but I did, and we have,
you might as well.
Yeah. Yeah. But like that he, you know, serves as like the midpoint reveal, is great. In the same way, you know, the alien chestburster is a great midpoint.
Just like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah. First thing I thought of when I met Bruno.
I thought so. Yeah. but that he's also, you know, kind of like a clone character in a way of
course, Isabel,
right? Of like, this is the disaster scenario. This is what she's like afraid of. This is the consequences of what happens when you don't like fit in. Like it's doing all of that. But again, somehow it's doing that where he doesn't feel like, you know, he's not bitter or like angry at the family. Like there's still like so much love there. And that's another like fine line that this movie somehow manages to navigate, where even Arabelle is like super, like she loves her family. She wants
She's
to
not
be
bitter.
Right. There's no bitterness from anyone really toward anybody. A little bit of frustration, I guess, toward Bruno. But that like, yeah, you never feel, this kind of cynical, it's too late. Like, I don't even want to be in this family. There's always like love happening there, which makes you always believe that there is room for reconciliation and that like secretly everyone does want the same thing.
Well, I was paying close attention this time, and it's the moment where she sees that he lives mostly behind the kitchen and that he has painted a plate for himself, like on his little seat, and written his own name on it, right? Where so he can like pretend to himself that he's still having dinner with his family. And I think that's so key, right? Because the central conflict is not that when your family hurts you, you have to decide whether to leave or stay or care about what they think or not. The central conflict is, what if you cared so much about your family and wanted so much to be with them and be a part of them, but felt like they couldn't accept you or you weren't good enough to be a part of them? And those are different. Like, that's a different theme, right? It's not that like, oh, you know, my family hurt me and now I don't care or whatever. It's, I really, really, really care. And no, it's basically impossible for them to hurt me so much that I don't want to be with them. And that's, you know, what happened in Bruno's case. And so like, despite everything, he still wishes desperately that he could be a part of his family. He just kind of acknowledges that he like, in fact, you know, it's almost a self-esteem problem where he thinks that he's bringing them nothing but trouble. And so they're better off without him, but he still wishes he could be a part of them. And I just think that that's really well observed and like a beautiful and very well expressed nuanced theme about family. I don't feel like we necessarily get that kind of theme very much. That's so carefully handled, right? And that's the thing, because, yeah, as you're pointing out, Michael, Mirabelle and Bruno are basically the same. They love their family an incredible amount, and it's they worry that they don't measure up, not that their family is in some way, like, toxic. It's not that the family is toxic, right? Even though there is some, like, damage there, it's that for whatever reason, their gifts or their lack of gifts make them feel alienated or like they're not good enough.
When it's like there's a very specific kind of family story happening here too, which is kind of an immigrant story or a generational trauma story where, you know, there's a reason why Abuela is so fearful of losing everything. It's because she did lose everything at some point in her life. She got back on her feet because of Magic Candle, but basically, you know, she represents a generation in a family that lost everything and built from scratch and, you know, has that fear in the back of their mind that everything could be lost again. The kids don't feel that because they've always been fine. And so it's really getting at that kind of story where it's about that kind of generational trauma and that conflict versus like mom and dad, you don't get me, like, I'm going to be independent and like, screw you. Like, that's a different kind of like parent-child conflict. This is about, I have high expectations that are almost fear-based for my descendants because I'm terrified we're going to lose it all again. And so instead of letting you be yourself or let you be who you are, I need you to be a certain role that will make me feel confident that, you know, this family will stay intact in the way that I understand is like safe. I think I really appreciate how focused this movie is on that particular kind of family conflict and not rebel punk kid versus right. parent kind right. of approach. Yeah.
There's also kind of a reverse chosen one narrative here. You know, I talked about this with Blade Runner 2049, actually, which is instead of being the special one, you find out that you're actually not the special one. And what does that mean? In Blade Runner 2049, he thinks he like maybe is not a replicant, right?
And that's spoilers, like, by the way.
Yeah. It's not a spoiler that he thinks he's not a replicant. but yeah, like what he chooses to do with the information he gets, sort of makes him special. And I think we get a similar thing here with Mirabelle, which is that by not being the quote unquote special one, you know, that gives her a different perspective. And then she ultimately is the one who is able to help save the house.
She gets the door at the end. I was done. Mm-hmm. And was like, yeah, that one, that hit me.
They give her the doorknob. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They tell her, they see her. Yeah. They see, like, how brave she's been. Stop it.
That's what this movie like made me upset. Because I'm like, I see what you're doing. It's so clear and it's so obvious and it's so in my face and it's so working and I'm so going to cry right now. God damn it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, it's a beautiful story about how not being the quote unquote special one can make you special, or like, you know, just that there's nuance. That's why, yeah, I appreciate it from like a zooming out meta perspective of like, there's the way we talk about specialness or celebrate specialness as, you know, cultures often leaves a lot on the floor and doesn't highlight things that are critically important to having a happy life and, you know, loving relationships and all these things. And so that this movie dramatizes that in a way that is like really fun is, I keep saying impressive, because it is really impressive. And I also feel like I wanted to just quickly mention the mom character is an interesting link in this generational chain, because she doesn't do a ton in the movie, but I think what she does do helps a lot, where like her mom and Mirabelle's mom and dad are both like, you don't need to be anything for us. Like, we still like love you unconditionally. And that they exist in this kind of in-between space between the generations, I think is another reason why it feels like there's hope, and that like Mirabelle's only choice isn't, well, I gotta go run away from home and dye my hair and be a punk and destroy it. Like, there's still, yeah, it's that there's still love and understanding, but it's just the circumstances are also are what they are. And as you pointed out, Alex, are serious and are, you know, the fear that is driving it is very real fear. So it's that intractable, very hard problem, which is why it's so compelling to see them struggle with it.
Well, and I think that the design of Mirabelle is also why the themes here feel so resonant and relatable and beautiful, which is just that, you know, from the very early scene where we see that she finds Antonio under the bed, right? And he's like kind of scared and, you know, he is just feels like he's not ready, right? He's apprehensive and like they've been roommates, right? They're cousins and he's been living in this room. Cause I guess you have to live in this room until you have to live with Mirabelle, I guess.
You don't get a magic room that's like infinite space. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. You have to live in this boring normal room where Mirabelle will have to live forever, I guess. Like, so anyway, but that scene does a lot of important character work where we see how much she cares about him, right? She made him this cute little stuffed animal and like that really adorable moment where she gives him a hug and then like grabs him again. She's like, oh, I gotta get an extra squeeze and I'm gonna miss having the world's best roomie. Like immediately I was like, Mirabelle, your power is empathy. Mm-hmm. Like, which is an ordinary human trait, right? Like a lot of people have empathy, but some people have extraordinary empathy. And that is Mirabelle's power. And we see her power at work on Luisa and we see her power at work on Isabella. And it really reminded me of It's a Wonderful Life, where I feel like...
Michael, that's a Christmas film.
Yeah. Yeah. Which has a really touching ending that I'm going to spoil for you since you haven't seen it.
At some point, a basketball floor opens and people fall into a pool.
He didn't get past that part.
Is that the ending?
Apparently.
That's the ending. That's really your thing. Okay.
That's the part everybody talks about and remembers for sure. Yeah. Yeah, the high school dance.
It's a Wonderful Life is a movie about George Bailey, who wants to be extraordinary and wants to live an extraordinary life. He wants to go travel the world. He wants to go, have adventures and be like notable maybe and get out of this crummy town. And that's a very American ambition, right? Like be notable, live a life of adventure and do something that people will tell a story about that's worthwhile. And what George Bailey discovers in that movie is that his very ordinary gifts and the very ordinary choices that he makes turn out to be the things that make him special. And like, the fact that he stays in his community and invests in his own community and gives up a lot of his dreams and sacrifices a lot of what he thought he wanted is in fact like what makes his life rich and worth living. And first of all, that was an extraordinary theme and message at that time in American history. But I feel like that's a very similar message here, right? Mirabelle wishes to be special. She's waiting on a miracle. She keeps, you know, that beautiful, her This Is What I Want song, right? It's like, I'm ready. Like, I've been patient. I've done everything I'm supposed to do. But like, I'm supposed to be special now. And what she discovers is that her very ordinary gift is still a real gift and a real power. And has a very intense and in fact is the impact is what's needed for her family and for her community. And very similar to It's a Wonderful Life, her community shows up for her at the end of this movie because of how, you know, to support her and her family because of the way that they have used their gifts and not necessarily because of their specialness. It's because of the way that they've invested in their community, their ordinariness, right? Just their presence in the community and the simple ways that they have helped. And so I think that that's, I don't know. Again, it's just so, it just doesn't feel American in so many ways, but I guess it's not. It's Colombian in this case. But yeah, it's such a refreshing message to hear from a movie like this, is that you don't have to be the actual princess or you actually have to get a gift at the end, right? Like I kept expecting, I was like, please don't give Mirabelle a gift at the end. And they don't,
right?
She has a gift. Her gift is just being who she is.
Thinking about those early scenes, like her save the cat scene, you know, you might call it, when she gives her cousin the present and is so sweet to him. Part of what this whole movie feels like, Disney has figured out how to do humans like in cartoon form really well. I mean, there was a period in early, you know, computer animation where we were in Uncanny Valley territory, where it's a little bit creepy. Like even in like the first Toy Story movie, it's a little weird.
People,
it doesn't feel like good. And whatever Encanto is doing is like just perfect, where they're so cartoon that there's no uncanny valley happening, but there's an essence of just like very recognizable faces and very clear emotions, and the big eyes are just like so emotive. They've cracked it. And so when you see these characters on screen with each other, like the emotion comes through so palpably that every single scene feels like there's like cheat codes added on top because of these like perfectly constructed faces and characters that are just emoting like with every pixel, you know, and it feels like it does transcend what even, you know, live action can do, because it's just been architected to like inch of its life to just communicate pure emotion as strongly as possible through, you know, the set, through the music, through the faces, through their movements, everything. And that's part of what makes movies like this feel so magical, is just it's everything is targeted at your heart, you know, like every inch of the screen, in a way that you just could never do in a live action setting.
Yeah, it's a really good point. You get the best of both worlds because you get that like crazy wide-eyed look that someone has, you know, where you look at them and they're caught red-handed and they just like so cartoony, right? That you could do in live action, but it just wouldn't pay off the same way. But now we can, as you're saying, Alex, we can do that. Like, you see a character look down and their smile fades a little bit, right? Those very like human emotions that you could, and I mean, don't get me wrong, you could do this in Aladdin, you could do this in Snow White and stuff, but we're able to do it in a way that feels just even more sort of immersive and tangible now.
There's no like work on your part required. I mean, right. I think there's like some forms of animation we're watching it and it's like, I'm almost participating in helping to construct like the full picture here.
Right.
But this is like, this just like goes down so easy. It's just like, Disney's just like, we have all the technology, we have the master artists, we know exactly how to do this. And it's just going to be so easy to take in.
Well, I want to know what you guys, speaking of all of this, because when you mentioned the characters' movements, Alex, what I think about is watching the characters dance. And I want to know what you think about the choice to have the animated characters dance in this, because I was kind of struggling to think of other examples of Disney movies that feel, where the musical numbers feel choreographed, not just in their like, I don't know. I went to something like, you know, Never Had a Friend Like Me, right? From Aladdin. Mm-hmm.
Thought about that. Yeah.
Which is like, okay, we're flashing around. Genie's doing all kinds of magic stuff. He's dancing. There's like magical sets popping here and there. We're kind of in this abstracted musical space thing where just like stuff's flying around and Aladdin's flying around or whatever. But I didn't think of very many other examples where animated characters are dancing. And I'm curious to know if it, like, how you guys felt when you were watching it the first time.
Dancing was my favorite part of like the whole movie, basically. But it, because I feel like, because I remember you mentioning in maybe in the your what you're watching, mm-hmm. of yeah, the dancing element and kind of those musical elements. But it felt like to me that it didn't feel musically in the same way, like we're dancing to perform for an audience. It felt like the characters were just dancing to the music because they wanted to dance most of the time. Like, it didn't feel like they were putting on a show, you know, and thinking about, you know, we don't talk about Bruno and there's lots of like little moments of dancing. And some of them are like, you know, to camera, but it also just kind of feels like this is a family that dances. This is part of like their familial like culture and relationship is like, yes, cousin, I'm going to grab you and we're going to do a cool little move while I'm whispering to you about Bruno. And, you know, and the wedding day dance, I don't know. I feel like it felt organic and not performative in a way that I really liked, but did definitely remind me of Never Had a Friend Like Me from Aladdin, or Aladdin with Will Smith, which came out more recently.
It's interesting you mentioned that, Trisha, because I think the part where it almost bumped for me and I had to kind of adjust myself was in that opening, you know, the family song where Mirabelle, she's really doing a lot of like, you know, using her dress as like a prop and in her dancing. And that did strike me as different. You know, there was a lot of attention called to like, oh, like you're treating this dress as if you are on stage doing something with your costume. Like, it's not, it didn't feel like animated movie dress. It felt like this is like a thing with weight that I have to actually physically move to do my dance moves, as she's kind of like trotting around town or crossing the bridge. Or so that was interesting, and it felt different than, like, you know, Belle twirling in a dress or some other kind of animated, yeah, sequence that I've seen before where characters are dancing, but there was something about the way she was using her dress that felt live action-y and different. And after that, everything else felt pretty seamless. But that was the one moment that felt like I'm watching somebody on stage in, like, West Side Story, you know, move their dress around as they dance on stage, as opposed to magical Disney character just kind of can glide around and their dress will just move however it needs to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think for me, I overall really have come around on it. It is just different when you have, you know, thinking about We Don't Talk About Bruno, as you mentioned, Michael, where you've got the family singing around the dinner table and, like, they're putting the plates down and they're, like, switching stuff around like that. And there's a coordination to that, as well as the stuff that's in abstracted space, like Luisa's song, Surface Pressure, mm-hmm. which is really great. I love that song. I love Luisa. Anyway, but a lot of that stuff, when the characters are dancing in a way that feels embodied for the characters themselves, like the character is making a choice to dance in this scene, I thought at first was pretty distracting, because we're just not used to it. We don't have a lot of, like I said, there's not a lot of points of reference for it in animated musicals. It's normally like characters are walking around and singing. Right. Like, a lot of the time they're walking and singing, and maybe, like, some visual movement in time with the music is happening around them. Like, I was thinking about the opening number of Mulan, where Mulan is getting dressed up to go see the matchmaker. And there's stuff happening around her that is to the beat of the music, but it's not dancing per se. So we're very used to seeing that. But we're not as used to seeing, or there's, like, a performance aspect to certain musicals. So, like, there's a couple scenes in Coco, right, where he's, like, singing because he's on stage, and, like, that's a movie that's, I guess it's a musical, but it has elements where it makes sense. The character has an instrument and he's standing on a stage, so of course he would be doing a dance, or whatever. There just are not a lot of points of reference for this. And if there are some I'm forgetting about, please tell me. Another one of the ones I thought of was in the movie Anastasia, which is a Don Bluth animated musical. The opening number, which is called Rumor in St. Petersburg, there's some coordinated, like, animated dancing among, like, people on the street in St. Petersburg in Russia in that movie. But there's so little, like, I'm grasping at straws. I'm trying to figure out what visual language this is tapping into. And I'm not saying it doesn't work, because I think overall it does hold together. It just really, I just taken aback by it in a number of different scenes. And so I'm very curious. Yeah, even thinking about more modern ones like Moana and Frozen, the characters are walking and singing, or they're sailing and singing, or they're in that, you know, weird abstracted animated space where, like, Maui is singing and dancing, kind of, where he's explaining where all of his powers come from. None of you guys know, you haven't seen Moana, but trust me on this. There are some musical numbers where in that abstracted space where there's kind of dancing happening, but, like, physically embodied in the world of the story, their feet planted on solid ground, the characters dancing. I just don't know if we have much of that, and I like it in this movie, but it's so singular and unusual, I find.
Right. I mean, it adds to the whole musical thing we talked about in West Side Story, which is, like, do the characters know they're singing? Right. Like, sure. Are the characters in the story singing, or are they talking, but we as the audience are seeing a song? Right. And then you add dance to that, and that compounds it even more. Like, did all these characters in this musical learn how to do the same dance and they're doing it? No. In the world of the musical, they are just moving from point A to point B. But we as the audience are seeing the, like, fantasy dance version of this. And I think that maybe what is different for you, because I didn't notice it at all as like a strange thing, because I was just thinking like that's what all animated musicals do, isn't it? And I'm looking now through Under the Sea from Little Mermaid and Emperor's New Groove, and there absolutely are choreographed moments of there's a bunch of characters on screen and, you know, all the lobsters are moving this way and all the, you know, octopodes are moving this way. Or octopuses, if you like.
Wow.
Yeah. But as you were saying, Tricia, it's like one of like 20 things going on during a 3-minute musical number, where it's like usually like, yeah, the characters are walking and they're singing, you know, singing while they're walking and in time. But then like there's a montage where you're getting a haircut and then and there's a guy and then there's a window washer, right? Like it's all this kind of just like boom, 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 random things coming in. Mm-hmm. And then, or the Prince Ali from Aladdin, like you
right,
do
get
then the finale usually, which is like, it may only be 20 seconds, but you do get a finale of now we're going to see a whole bunch of characters and they are actually doing a choreographed dance. But they're in a parade or they're under the sea or whatever. But I think the difference is in Encanto, because the story is so much more focused, you are just seeing a family hanging out together. So it's more noticeable when you see a family hanging out together suddenly start getting up and dancing than it is when you're seeing a parade, like you said, a parade or a bunch right. of sea creatures or, you know, whatever. When they sort of get together and dance, you're like, well, sure, because we're already in like crazy crowd, you know, world anyway. So anyway, I didn't really notice it, but now I'm fascinated by this and I want to think about it for a long time.
This is all that I've been thinking about. And also
this is like Trisha's thing.
Yeah. Is this how you guys feel like, about me when I do anything that I do? And
get we don't talk about how we feel about you.
Okay.
The thing is, this movie is so grounded and nuanced in all of the ways that we've already identified, right? Where it's like, even though it's a family about, it's a story about a family with magical powers, it's so, like the central conflict and themes are so grounded. And the scope is so small and narrow. That when the characters, even when they're actually not dancing, but they're doing things like coordinated, but still, again, embodied in the real world, not in abstract and musical space, not in montage space, when they're singing, like even in the finale, and they give her her doorknob and they're just singing at her, I'm just like, this is a very live action musical thing that I'm watching, but it's animated. And I don't know about some of that stuff.
Well, it's interesting because that part of what you're identifying, even if this isn't what the Renaissance Disney movies actually did, this is what it feels like to me, I guess. Like moments where characters mid normal scene break into song does feel Renaissance Disney to me in a way that we haven't seen from the kind of Pixar modern Disney era. And so to me, it all just reminded me of a kind of an older time. Mm-hmm. And I think in particular it worked for me in this context because the world is so insane, even though yes, it's very focused on this family. I mean, like their rooms can take up infinite space and time and be full of just flower towers or a giant staircase. I mean like the world is insane. Sure. Actually, if you look at objectively, and we do see them, you know, in the celebration night for the new cousin's power, they are just dancing like at a party. And so there is that kind of just like Latin, you know, we just dance, you know, kind of a thing. So I think both those things combined, plus me just shifting into like Renaissance Disney mode, made it all just kind of feel appropriate. Whereas I think if this was like a normal Pixar film in every other way, but then people just broke into choreographed dance and sang at me, I would be like, whoa, this is weird. But I think this movie, once I clicked in after that first musical number of like, okay, this is like Renaissance style Disney, then I do just kind of accept, yep, they started off this scene talking and now they're singing at each other, and that's just what happens in these movies.
I think that's fair.
Yeah.
I couldn't get there, but I'm with you.
Yeah, it's so interesting, and I want to talk about it for forever, but probably shouldn't. We should probably move on to lessons.
Yeah, we should.
And what lessons we're going to take away from Encanto. Brian, do you want to start us off?
Sure. My lesson is about Luisa's song, Surface Pressure. Or at least that was the song that made me lock into my lesson, which is sort of about all the songs, you know, and in our West Side Story episode, I talked about how, especially in older musicals, there are songs that don't actually do anything for the story. They're there to be a song, you know, or to maybe sort of like live with an emotion for a couple minutes and entertain the audience, but they're not developing character. They're not moving the plot forward. They're not really doing a lot. I was tracking that in this movie just because it had been on my mind. And I'm pretty sure every single song in this movie is either moving the plot forward, revealing character, providing exposition, or in the case of the two sister songs, which are sort of symmetrical, probably, you know, and structurally in the movie, they're exploring the theme. And, you know, Luisa's song, and Luisa is not a terribly important character in this movie in terms of, like, if you actually say what the plot of the movie is, she doesn't really enter into it all that much. But it's a huge introduction of what the theme is and how Mirabel, you know, relates to the other characters in her family. So she is singing about all the expectations placed on her and how she would maybe rather be in Mirabel's place. And then meanwhile, Mirabel had an expectation, you know, her inciting incident into this world was you failed to live up to your expectation through no fault of your own. And then that's just who you are now. You are the one in this family who failed to live up to that expectation. And then now what's expected of her is to go stand in the corner while the magical, you know, people do their thing. And maybe you just, you know, don't cause any trouble, just stay over there. And she would rather be in any other family member's place. So I just think it's a great example that you could have had a song that's just a fun song. Like, oh, we have this sister with this power. What are some fun, kooky things she can do in a song? But instead, it absolutely does this huge take on the theme and really, you know, and because Mirabel is actually there in the song too, it's not just like we're going to focus on some other character for a little bit. It's like you are seeing the two of these characters interacting and how Mirabel feels about everything that she is talking about. And, you know, I just think, like, I love movies like this to kind of do like structure 101 or theme 101 or whatever. And I like to think that if you ask a six-year-old who's seen this movie 20 times by now, you know, what is this movie about? Maybe they couldn't answer you, you know, but I like to think putting songs like this in there will maybe help, like, fire off some of those synapses and be like, oh, well, there's this thing and there's the thing. And like, that sister has that song and that sister, and they're both about kind of how there's something expected of them. And then the main character, you know, like, you could maybe work together a theme. You could sew one out of that tapestry of songs here. And it's just, of course, that's not just, doesn't apply to musicals only. It's like any movie, whatever your B plot is, or your C plot is, like, hopefully that is reflecting the theme. But I just think this is a great example of just this very focused 3 to 4 minute, we're going to spend some time with this character, but if you're paying attention, you're going to understand what we're talking about here. We're not just having a fun little side adventure and then we're going to get back to the story. And that's why I never felt, I love Coco, but there were definitely parts of Coco where I felt like, all right, we got to get to the place to get the other thing to then get up to this guy and then go over and meet this thing, you know, and this, I always felt like I was connected even during the songs. And that can be a problem with me with musicals, is during the songs I'm like just waiting for the story to continue. And I felt every song in this movie was doing something that it couldn't be cut. Like, if it was cut, the movie wouldn't be the same.
Yeah. I'm on a second that, just, you know, I had similar feelings about Coco, where I really appreciated the movie and it was beautiful and lovely and fun, but yeah, there were those parts where I was like, this isn't doing all the things at once, you know, the way that I like want for my best Disney Pixar movies. And this is an example of, yeah, you can study this movie just like you can study the best Pixar films, of just 101. Here is an amazingly tight screenplay. Everything's on the surface. You can see it so clearly, and everything's doing 5 things at once throughout the whole thing. And it's just so satisfying.
Mm-hmm. I love how the middle act of this movie is just Mirabel talks to a family member who tells her to talk to another family member. That's like the entire boom, 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 boom.
Yep.
And that's even what the crisis is too. It's like Mirabel talks to the family member she should have started by talking to.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even Bruno coming back into the picture happens in the middle of a song.
Yep.
So again, you couldn't just cut the song out of the movie because it is the climax of the movie, basically.
Louisa's song's interesting because I think that's when I locked into the movie for sure. I was still kind of at a distance and like wasn't necessarily like even Mirabelle's like, "This is what I want" song was a little bit like, okay, you're gonna okay. Yeah. For me, but like yeah, I feel like that song, Louisa's song's when it really started firing on all cylinders for me. And partially because it started leaning into the Aladdin-ness of it, of like, mm-hmm. I'm gonna sing, yeah. We're all over the place. Like, this is abstract and weird and like all kinds of stuff. Or like
Titanic.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's like goofy. So it's like there's so many like, yeah, channels of information coming at you that's going with the music in a really like fun, exciting way that also made me coming out of this be like, can we do live action musicals anymore? Like, I feel like animated movies are just very well suited to it. I don't want to open a whole can of worms, but like West Side Story didn't really work for me as far as musical stuff goes. And I think partially because there were just like less like, you know, frequencies of fun musicalness stuff happening. And this movie just does it so well. Anyway, I'll save some of this for my lesson, but Brian's lesson. Good. Thumbs up. Alex, what's your lesson?
So my lesson is about prophecy stories, thinking about, yeah, how do you do a prophecy story? Because if you know the future and know the ending, then that takes all the suspense out. And this movie pulled the Minority Report thing where you show what's to come, but out of order, out of context. You see pieces of the future, but you don't know like what's going to happen. It's unclear which way it's going to go. And if you're going to have a prophecy like that, then it creates these markers for the audience to be watching out for, which is fun. So you see, oh, there's the butterfly. There's the moment where she and her sister hug. What does it mean? But you don't see the full picture until it all clicks into place in the finale. So I think it's just a very deftly, they handled the idea of a prophecy very well. And I think it's a good lesson for if you're going to base a story around a prophecy, this shows some tips and tricks of how to deal with that. I always just like having images and symbols like in Minority Report that you are anticipating seeing. So when they come, you get that little aha moment and, but it was in this context, actually. It's not what I thought it was. That's just very satisfying.
I love the look, the like prismy look of the prophecy where you fold it one way and the house is that way. And that it's a very cool visual representation of the thing you're talking about.
It did make me want one of those. Like,
oh, totally.
Well, yeah. I don't know what it would be.
I feel
of,
like at Disneyland,
but I want that.
You can probably already buy that.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. Cool. Trisha, what's your lesson?
Yeah, mine has to do with songs at the major plot beats and the crisis song in this. So I feel like in a lot of movie musicals, animated musicals, the crisis song is a song for the hero, and it's often a reprise, like a sad reprise of their "This Is What I Want" song. And I think that it's really lovely to see this crisis song go a different direction. And it's really a song about the abuela, right? And it's not even sung by any of the characters. It's just played in Spanish over a montage that gives us more complete information and shows us the complete story about what happened and why, you know, sort of the motivations behind why Abuela is acting the way that she is. And that's sort of the whole conflict of the plot. And I think that there's a reason why that song is not as catchy to the under 10 set. Not just because it's in Spanish, but because it's just sort of this like soft, sad sort of folk ballad for a crisis song, where it's much easier to have. Well, so most of the songs that arise as being like the singles out of Disney Renaissance animated musicals are "This Is What I Want" songs. Those are the big sweeping like This Is My Heart's Desire ballads. Like Let It Go is essentially a This Is What I Want song. And then
Just Wanna Be King.
Yep. Just Can't Wait to Be King. Reflections from Lon is another one, right? Part of Your World is from Little Mermaid. That one's the best one in that movie. And it's interesting that Waiting on a Miracle, which is the This Is What I Want song from this movie, is not the hit, right? It's interesting that the midpoint song is the hit from this movie, which I think is fascinating. But the one nominated for an Oscar was the Crisis song. And I just think it's a really bold choice. And I think it's a really lovely way to frame the central conflict, which is Mirabelle, you don't understand. And maybe if you did understand, you would be able to connect and heal the thing you need to heal, which is your relationship with your grandmother. You know, you've been chasing all around the source of the problem with the magic, like through every single one of your other family members, but you haven't stopped to ask the one person who would be able to tell you, you know? And so I think that it's for a movie with the scale that this movie has, which is a very internalized family conflict scale, and the kind of, yeah, small, essentially small crisis that we've identified, it would be the wrong decision to give a big sweeping ballad to either her grandmother or to her. And so I like the choice to make this sort of a soft, quiet song about like grief and, you know, the trauma, as you mentioned, Alex, that she lived through, and it becomes a realization point for them both. And then Mirabelle has that wonderful, like, you kept us together. The reason we are family is because of you, where she takes back what she said basically before. And so I just think that if you are writing a movie structurally and trying to check boxes about plot beats, not all crises look alike. They don't all have to sound alike either. In the same way that not all, you know, breaks into two or midpoints are all the same. Like, I think there's a cookie cutter way to do this that's way worse. And the fact that it seemed there was a lot of care taken to make this a thoughtful crisis point is just speaks volumes. And I think that that's why I think the finale song becomes even more sort of like triumphant and fun because there was this like really quiet crisis song. So
I mentioned at one point a Malcolm Gladwell podcast series of episodes where he rewrote the ending to The Little Mermaid with Britt Marling to be more like modern and PC and have like, what are the morals that we actually think are good and that we should be like teaching children? And, you know, it was done hastily and through a Malcolm Gladwell lens. So it like could have, I would not be surprised if it came off as super annoying to a lot of people. As like, here's the maybe clunky and too on the nose way to do it. I feel like Encanto is like the perfect way to do it that accomplishes all the things that, you know, he brought up in that episode that he and Britt Marling were trying to solve. This does it in like a super effortless way. And I think, as you're pointing out, Trisha, it's this kind of subversive, different approach to the crisis where the crisis is actually like empathy for the antagonist moment. Like, that's not a thing that is in, you know, Blake Snyder's, you know, beat sheet kind of thing. And I think this is, yeah, a really cool model to look to moving forward of how to tell stories that aren't just, as we mentioned already, bad guy does a thing, now we have to get everybody together to go punch the bad guy until we win. And I think it's powerful for all the reasons that you just outlined. So it's one of the things I love about this movie.
Tell us about your lesson, Michael.
Yeah, my lesson, I think, is just the power of aesthetics. I think I'm always very tuned into structure and story and have kind of trained myself over the last many years to like, but if you stripped away all the colors and all the like acting and everything, like what does the story do and is that good enough? And I feel like this movie, as we talked about, has all those great structural story moments, but it's just like, it overwhelmed me with how much the aesthetics of it elevated that story and made it
the color. So much color.
Right, like, yes, colorful, bold, the animation, as we talked about. And I think the, you know, I watched some of the behind the scenes and like the sort of design of the We Don't Talk About Bruno song and how they brought in choreographers and used reference, you know, videos of actual people moving. And so that there is this, as you were talking about, Alex, I guess, like this pinnacle seems to have been reached where it's realistic. It feels human. You like the characters have the weight that they should, but it's also still magical and special and larger than life. And it's such, yeah, this is just such a great showcase. Like the story is such a great showcase for that, and have it being a musical, and that it, I think, helps to dramatize and make emotional an arc that might be difficult if you were trying to shove it into the, you know, but now we have to go punch people mold. Yeah, aesthetics are good in movies. It's not a lesson that most people need to be reminded of, but I do sometimes.
Super quickly, aesthetics, but also like comedy. I feel that the jokes in a lot of more modern animated movies feel more like referency, or they get dated really quickly. Yeah, exactly. And I think because this is in like a time out of place world, the jokes have to be like funny in and of themselves. And I think they really are. And a lot of that's just Mirabelle and like sort of her physical comedy that she has. The scene where she's in Bruno's room and like climbing the staircase and talking to the toucan is so funny to me.
The look like, that toucan gives her also at that one point is like, how did they get that Alan look Tudyk on a bird?
It's like, for some reason, that is so funny to me because she's, I don't know, the way the character moves and like is singing to herself is really hilarious. But yeah, I just think that the comedy is also what makes it like sparkle, right? Like the aesthetics make it sparkly and stand out. And also the comedy here is really well done and I think does make it stand out. She goes, at least I have a friend. Nope, he flew away immediately. It just makes me laugh every time.
Yeah. Speaking of sparkles, I think I wrote a note down actually when a couple of like the early sparkly door scenes, there's even like a musical cue that comes up that just felt like classic Disney. Like this is magical sparkly door music. And I'm really like soothed right now because I'm being transported to just like, this is just like core Disney feels when magical things are happening. This kind of music is happening and it just looks super pretty. So I just appreciate that too. Like, you know, bring me back there, Disney. Just give me a magical door with some sparkles.
One of my friends hired an artist to paint her daughter's door in like an Encanto style with like all the stuff that she loves around her with like her name on it.
That's epic.
I need a sparkly door.
That's great.
Don't we all?
Awesome. Okay. Well, what else have you guys been watching? Brian, what have you been watching recently?
Because it's finally coming out for a wide release this month, I can talk about Petite Maman, the new Celine Sciamma movie of Portrait of a Lady on Fire fame. I mentioned when I marathoned her filmography sometime last year that her first two movies were like these really short, lo-fi dramas with a small cast, and this is very much leaning back into that. It's 72 minutes. It has maybe five characters in it. Very simply shot. You know, it is not the movie you would expect following Portrait of a Lady on Fire, but I love that. I love that she's just like, no, I'm keeping it here. I'm keeping it with my roots. And the story is really interesting. Nellie, who is maybe 11, she and her family are at her mother's childhood home after her maternal grandmother passes away, so her mother's mother. And the mother is upset and just leaves during the night without saying goodbye, and they're not really sure, like, you know, does she just need some time? Where is she? Whatever. The next day, Nellie goes into the woods and she meets a little girl playing in the woods, played by that actress's twin sister. Like her, the girl who plays Nellie, that actress, her twin sister. It becomes very clear that it is her mother as a child that she is now interacting with in the woods. But it's not a time travel movie. It's not like I told her something and then she remembered it in the future, you know, or like I made a thing in the house and then it was there when I went back to my first. It's not interested at all in being that kind of movie. It's just like an impressionistic fable about this girl processing everything that's going on with her mother and her grandmother, who of course is alive in the past. And the movie's not interested at all in saying like, is this real? Is this all in her head? It doesn't matter because it's just not trying to, it's not trying to be that kind of a movie, like a time travel thing or a, it's all in her head thing. It's just like a, like I said, impressionistic kind of painting, you know, tone poem or something. And yeah, it's really beautiful. Like I said, it's very short. And it just gets in there and gets it done. And I can't wait to see what her next like big movie is, you know, to sort of follow up Portrait of Lady on Fire. But I'm just so happy that she's doing just like really simple focused things like this. And hopefully those of you in the States can actually see it sometime soon. So check it out when you can.
Awesome. That's cool. Yeah. Again, another great, bold, what if, just like go with it, audience. We don't need to explain it if it's part of our what if.
Right.
I was a fan of that. Awesome. Alex, what have you been watching recently?
So I saw Everything Everywhere All at Once in a nice, loud, big theater, which is how I'd recommend you see it. It's the new film by Daniels, and it's got a lot of buzz online, so you probably heard about it, starring Michelle Yeoh, and it's just a wonderful, insane, you know, it's in the spirit of Scott Pilgrim versus the World, just a really overambitious movie that is just so incredibly, it's a movie that as a director, I just, my brain hurts thinking about how do you plan this movie? How do you shoot this movie? Mm-hmm. How do you conceive of this movie? Because there's just so much going on. And I need to see it again just to take it all in because it's such a wild, like almost obscene ride. It feels like the Daniels kind of took all of our millennial influences and just poured them into one movie and just packed it all together. It's hard for me to even talk about it or like say like what it is. It's just, I think it's worth seeing in a nice big theater and just go for this wild millennial brain ride with the Daniels. And it strangely, or maybe not so strangely, it's following this trend that Trisha picked up on from several other animated films of having kind of like teenage daughter, family, you know, generational trauma being passed down. It's dealing with all those themes as well in another context and done very well. And the movie really brings home those themes in the final act in a really satisfying way. So it's not just, I mean, it's pretty wacky and goes to a lot of far out places that feel very disparate at times, but it all comes back together and it really sticks the landing. Which makes it feel special and not just wacky, weird, bizarre, kooky film.
Right.
It is those things, but it also is about something and it really sticks the landing about that thing. Definitely worth seeing in theaters if you can.
Yeah, it sort of has like a Lord and Miller energy to it, but like mm-hmm. live action and rated R. And
yes.
And, or the other thing I thought when I was watching it was like, what if Spike Jonze made The Matrix? Like mm-hmm. it's just sort of, it has like this like dreary office building vibe to it, but also it's basically the plot of The Matrix.
But also with Lord and Miller. Yeah,
yeah. Totally.
Yeah, I've got to take it to it this week and I'm very, very excited.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Awesome. Cool. Trisha, what have you been watching?
So I am watching a movie that's also about a large family with a lot of characters. Not a movie, actually. A TV show that you might have heard of called Bridgerton. Season 2 is out. And I think I mentioned that I was watching the first season of Bridgerton when it was out. And the second season is now out. And I am enjoying it very much. It's interesting because... So the first... For those that don't know, Bridgerton is, you know, a drama, sort of a costume drama, romantic drama that's sort of like in, if like Pride and Prejudice were like really sexy and modern and sort of existed in like a fantasy world, basically. Anyway, the first season is about this one romance between these two central characters, and they were not able to get the actor from that romance to come back for the second season. Roger Jean Page did not return. He is gorgeous to look at and was the main reason that a lot of people watched the first season. And he has not returned. However, I thought there's no possible way that the second season losing its male lead could be like the same show or good at all.
And it's working for me, though. Like, they've introduced new characters. They've kind of shifted the focus to a character that was already in the first season and was a big part of the first season, has now become the central character or the new sort of male lead. And it's still really enjoyable. And, you know, it's, I'm not going to call it high art or anything like that. it's even slightly pornographic in places, but it's like, it's something fun to watch that has actually pulled off something pretty difficult to do, which is like, you basically lost one of the main reasons people were watching your show. He's not in it anymore. What do you do? And it's like, it's good. What they've done with it is impressive. So I'm, you know, still hooked into it, and I'm not done with the season yet, so no spoilers, please. But really enjoying Bridgerton season two.
Hey, it's Shonda Rhimes.
I know, man.
Grey's Anatomy is still going. How many characters have they lost in Grey's Anatomy? There's like maybe one, two original cast members still in
when
that
show. When you've got a great engine and you know, like, yeah. I feel like this very precise flavor of tea cake is what I'm going to call it. You know what you're serving? Like, just slice that Shonda up and land. Serve it. Yeah. Like, and it'll work.
Yeah.
Nice. That is, yeah, I noticed that Dude Face wasn't in the posters for the second season. I was like, what happened? So it's interesting to hear that they couldn't get it. He was just too pretty and he had to go on and do other pretty stuff, it sounds like.
I assume so. Don't worry, there are other pretty people in the show.
Nice. Excellent. Cool. I recently started watching Schitt's Creek.
It
has
welcome.
Been recommended to me. Thank you for many years. And I have dividend. I have dividend yeah. into the, I think I'm like halfway through season three, maybe getting to the end of season three. It's a really weird show. And so, yeah, for people that don't know the premise, super rich family loses all their money, has to move into a town called Schitt's Creek. They're super poor, live in a motel. And then it's just that, them dealing with that and the, like, the local townsfolk and stuff. And it's, I can't tell, like it's a comedy, but what kind of comedy is it? But it's also like a little bit of a drama, but not so much that it's like, you know, like The Office where it like hardcore goes into like, and now you're going to cry mode. But I am like really emotionally connected to these characters. It's really fascinating and been a wild ride so far, and unlike literally anything I've seen before. So yeah, Schitt's Creek, I'm enjoying it. It's really hard not to just yell David at everyone constantly. I feel like I also secretly am David and look up to him. Anyway, it's fun. I'm enjoying it.
Nice.
And this has been our conversation about Encanto. Yeah, we want to say a big thank you, as always, to the patrons that make this show possible. Thank you to our producer, Vince Major. Thank you to our editors, Caleb Berg, Graham Harther, and Eric Schneider. I'm Michael Tucker, and I've been joined today by Trisha Rand, Brian Bittner, and Alex Calleros. All of our Twitter handles are in the show notes. Send us a tweet and say hi, and we'll see you in the next episode.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.